This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on January the 18th, 2016, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, an historic prisoner swap followed by more sanctions. We'll look at the latest in US and Iranian diplomacy. Then, following last night's debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, we'll take the temperature of the US presidential politics on the Democratic side. And speaking of the race for the White House, Donald Trump is ruffling feathers around the world with his controversial opinions and remarks. But should some countries slap Trump with a travel ban as a result? The UK is having that debate, and so will we. And a bit later on, the international glitterati are heading to the Swiss Alps yet again this week, this time for the World Economic Forum. We'll talk Davos and new stats about the global 1%. That's all to come on Midori House, starting right now with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guest today are Xenia Wickett and Tim Marshall. Tim is editor of The What and TheWhy.com and former diplomatic editor of Sky News. And Xenia is director of the US programme at Chatham House here in London. Welcome both to the show. Let's kick off today's show with some good news. After 545 days behind bars on espionage charges, the Washington Post Tehran correspondent Jason Rezaian has been released from an Iranian prison along with four others in return for Iranian prisoners. The negotiations for the swap have been happening behind the scenes for months. Meanwhile, Iran has denounced fresh sanctions imposed by America over its ballistic missile program. But let's start with the good news on the prisoner swap first. Tim, maybe starting with you, as a journalist watching what happened to Jason Rezaian. In fact, somebody who in the early days of Monocle 24 was a regular check-in voice here on Monocle 24 for us as well from Tehran.
It is good news, and he was essentially a political prisoner, a pawn in the whole big game between Iran and the USA. It was interesting, we now know clearly why when the US sailors were arrested last week, they were released so quickly. It was terrible timing. All this was clearly coordinated that this was going to happen, that the IAEA would say clean bill of health. At that point, the EU and the US would say sanctions lifted. At that point, they'd say the prisoners are out. And suddenly you threw into that mix these sailors. So that this explains why they were suddenly released so quickly.
And do you imagine back when we had the negotiations about the, you know, the nuclear deal, at the time Obama was heavily criticised for not making this, you know, a footnote of that deal and getting Jason Rezaian out at that time. But do you imagine there was probably a bit of discussions with the Iranians saying, we'll do it in our own time, we'll do it once you have implemented, you know, this agreement?
There will have been relatively coded conversations probably between them, and that they'll have been giving them the nod, you know, just we need this, give us this. And I think the Iranians have probably got a lot more out of this, and it's very easy to keep an American in jail for a year and a half, and then at the time of your choosing, off you go. So the Iranians have done quite well. We're about to see they've got about 20 billion, excuse me, million barrels of oil. They can just suddenly put that out onto the world market, which won't alter the cost that much, but they're about to start pumping 500,000 barrels a day. And that is going to make absolutely sure, I think, that the oil price will stay low this year. Secondly, they're back home for business, big time. And you will see a stampede of people to turn around now, trying to get that business.
Xenia, when we look at this deal, let's stay with the negotiations first of all. There's much criticism now. You know, did too many people get released in return for these American prisoners? There's a body count being done by the Republican side. How is America feeling about this prisoner swap?
I think you need to take a step back. I mean, of course there's a body count being done by the Republicans. Of course the Republicans are saying that this isn't a good deal, because it was done under Obama's watch. If it had been reversed, you can absolutely guarantee that the Democrats would be saying how terrible this was, and the Republicans would be saying, isn't this a wonderful sign of the prowess of our negotiators? So, I mean, for a second, I think we need to get away from the politics of this and the fact that, of course, it's silly season in the United States, and anything that is a win for Obama right now will have the Republicans out, you know, with their hair on fire. If we do take a step back and look at this strategically, I mean, I agree with Tim, this is good for the Iranians. This is also really good for the West as well. The situation in which we were existing was not a long-term solution. The fact that actually, I mean, I would argue that the even though the nuclear negotiations were done very, very clearly, it was said, this is just the nuclear negotiations. We're not getting involved in questions on Israel. We're not getting involved in questions on trading prisoners. This is purely down to the compartment that is the Iran negotiations, the nuclear negotiations. That was successful. Of course, when you have one success, that can lead to all sorts of other successes. And I somewhat agree with Tim. I think that the negotiations last week about the sailors' release, that was when you can pick up the phone and make a conversation happen and results happen, that is a huge success. That is what President Obama said in his kind of opening gambit, if you will. You know, I will reach out my hand when he took office, if you will reach back out towards me. That's essentially what it's done, and we are beginning to see the fruits of this. Does that mean it's going to be easy? Does that mean it's going to be fluid here on out? No, absolutely not. I am fully sure that over the next couple of years, we're going to see lots and stops and starts in this relationship. But the fact that you can actually pick up the phone to somebody senior and say, we need to do this, we need to do that, this is how we need to treat things, without it getting elevated into very, very high levels of tension, is a very positive thing.
Tim, do you think it makes the world, beyond the nuclear question, do you think it makes the world a bit of a safer place, or potentially a safer place? And, you know, because
no.
What we're interested, well, I guess what everyone's interested to see is what flows from this. Do we see some, you know, some negotiation around Syria?
No, I think we see less. That's the problem. If this sticks, if this works, if Iran is not going to cheat, and I think the inspections regime is exceptionally weak, leave that to one side. If it works, if it sticks, the world is a safer place. There is one fewer country, less countries that's going to have nuclear weapons, we hope. The world is a safer place. And as we've agreed, there is now a communication channel between the United States and Iran. Fine.
But is it as...
You said leaving aside nuclear. Right, well, Iran is not about to stop funding Hezbollah. It's not about to stop propping up the Assad regime. It's not about to stop fighting a proxy war in Yemen, partially in Iraq, where it is busy assembling militia, which are growing to such an extent that they are beginning to challenge the Iraqi army and who is the biggest boy in Iraq. And it's the Shia militia funded by Iran. So all those things are now going to keep going. And given what the Saudis and the Gulf states are saying, because they hate this deal, absolutely hate it. I was reading an editorial today in Al Riyadh newspaper calling for Saudi now to start a peaceful civilian nuclear program, which would simply be a cover for a nuclear weapons program, because they don't believe the deal will stick, in which case the world's not a safer place.
Senia.
I agree, and I think that it's certainly not a safe place in the short term, because what I don't think anybody is sufficiently thinking about, except for those people who are real Middle East experts, is the fact that you do, as Tim just said, you do have the Saudis and the Iranians sitting on opposite side of this, not even generational, centuries old antagonism between the two, with the willingness and the capacity to play proxy wars anywhere that they possibly can. And as Tim said, we're seeing this break out all over the place. And up till now, I would argue that in the United States and in the EU, those people who've supported the deals have ignored this huge long-standing conflict and said, oh, we can handle it. I mean, you did hear that from the Americans quite a lot. We can handle the tension between the Saudis, our friends, and the Iranians. They can't. I mean, it's just a fact of life. They cannot handle it. And so you've got an awful lot of people who are pro the deal who just haven't thought about the longer term, big strategic complications. And you've got those who are against the deal who also aren't talking about it, at least in the United States, because people don't like this intangible, well, what is this? It's long term, da, da, da. They're dealing with the short-term consequences of it. So you've actually got a lot of people, particularly in the United States, who really do not understand the implications of this deal and what it will do in terms of if Iran does come in from the cold, does become a serious member of the international community, and then you really are setting up the Iran-Saudi conflict to go at it again.
That last bit's really interesting because when the United States and the USSR used to negotiate arms reductions, the USA never thought to themselves, oh, and this will probably make them less communist and they won't be so revolutionary in their views. It was just reducing nuclear arms. There's this odd thing that has arisen in the last 20 years that, oh, if Iran does a deal with us on nukes, they will become less revolutionary. There is nothing to suggest that.
The only reason I might disagree with you is that what's interesting is I think here that behind the Iranian regime, whether it's the theocracy or Rouhani, there are
that's the same thing.
Well, kind of, and the guard and the military
all the
behind
same thing.
Them are thousands, hundreds of thousands of young people who feel that 20 years of their life has been lost and are keen to live quite commercialized. They want to go to restaurants, they want to get married, they want to buy stuff, they want to live that life. And that's the pressure. Because the interesting thing is, for Americans, the funny thing is, if you look at, Saudi society and Iranian society, which is the one that is actually a bit closer to America, it's
Iran.
Iranian. Yeah.
But here's the issue. They both want to be the regional hegemon. And you've got two large, powerful countries both wanting to be the regional hegemon. And they are going to play all sorts of proxy wars in order to ensure that they are. And they already are doing this.
And defend the revolution.
That's got nothing to do with whether you've got a whole load of 20-year-olds who want to actually engage in the Western society. They may want to engage in Western society. They also want to be the regional hegemon.
Oh, by the way, for every single one of those...
But doesn't that put demands on the people in power to say, hold on, before you go and squander our lives again... we want some kind of change.
It took 70 years in Russia, and every single one of those hundreds of thousands of young people that you say want to wear Levi's and push their headscarf right back to the back of their head, I will match every single one of them with a young person that wants to join the Basij militia, that wants to join the Revolutionary Guard. No one ever talks about them. I'm not saying I like them, but why aren't they representing Iranian youth?
But the trouble is, both of these groups, both the kind of the more Western-oriented and the more conservative, both of them also want Iran to be the regional hegemon.
What about my youth? What about the ones that I've just said? Nobody ever takes any notice of the fact that there's lots of extremely nasty and rabid nationalist young people in Iran.
Well, there are many. Just before we move on for this, because I've got a feeling we could stay on this for 30 minutes. So you're just on the tiny question of these additional sanctions now to do the ballistic missile program.
This is essentially America was very, very careful. It swapped 5 Americans held in Iran for 7 Iranians held in the United States, but they were all Iranians. They hadn't. What they had done was sell secrets or sell materials to Iran. So it was a very, very small subset of what's the word? Treason is not the word I'm looking for, but reasons that they were arrested. They also placed sanctions on 11 Iranian entities, individuals or corporations, again. Yep. Entities that had violated ballistic missile sanctions. So that's been very, very targeted by the United States, principally to say, look, we're not going to actually play softly with the Iranians, but also to make sure that the conversation continues.
Tim, was it done for belief or just done for home PR?
Well, they had to do it because Iran did fire test ballistic missiles in contravention of a UN resolution last October. So they had to do it, but it's not a deal breaker. As we've said, it's 11 people or companies who now have limited sanctions against them. And you put that against the $100 billion that's going to be unfrozen, the fact that Iran can now use the SWIFT payment system, the international payment system. That's the big stuff. This is peripheral. It will not break the deal.
I think we can both understand it. We are, I promise you, moving, Zenia, towards US politics at least. Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders went head-to-head on the finer details of policy at the 4th Democratic debate last night. Really intriguing to seeing the kind of the coverage of this, Zenia. Is this a kind of finally them kind of like beginning to really bash each other? Because, She's accused him of being like some NRA fan. He's accused her of kind of being unwise about, you know, her friendships with Goldman Sachs. It's like,
yeah. So I mean, they are in a somewhat civilized manner. They are beginning to go at it finally. I mean, the polls are getting close in Iowa and New Hampshire. Bernie Sanders is actually ahead of Hillary in New Hampshire and kind of head to head sort of in Iowa. So that means Hillary's kind of fighting a little bit harder and Bernie Sanders is fighting a little bit harder. It's not going to make any difference, by the by. And I think what is more interesting and more, if this didn't matter so much, more amusing is the fact if you contrast the Democratic debates with the Republican debate that took place 3 days earlier, I mean, you've still got the Republicans really going at it personally at one another, you know, whereas on the Democratic side, they're really talking, I mean, you've got a lot of policy wonks there talking about policy options and should you move slightly to the right or should you move slightly to the left? And there's very little personal. I mean, even when challenged by the moderator, you know, isn't it shocking that, you know, Bill Clinton has his history? And Bernie Sanders said, yeah, but I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, hang on a minute. He said, yes, I don't want to get personal. I don't want to talk about that. But what he did was despicable. He did get that jab in.
He did say what he did was
despicable. That's easy for you to say.
But he didn't actually say, and that's why Hillary Clinton is unacceptable.
Taking the temperature of the room at the end of it, what was your view of the...
It's not going to make any difference to how people vote in the Democratic primaries in the first couple of people have already made up their minds in the Democratic primaries. Could Bernie Sanders do slightly better as a result? Most people that I have read, most of the people I've spoken to have said, yes, he came out slightly ahead on that particular debate. But that's only because he didn't end up so far behind. I mean, it was, you know, expectations were low and therefore he surpassed expectations. It's not going to make any difference.
Tim, when you see these two players, you know, Bernie Sanders seems to have been making a big move on kind of medical care. Mm-hmm. There was some ructions. But what do you see as the real kind of one or two points that are going to decide it at the end of the day? The topics are really coming to the fore. You know, they held this debate just, you know, meters away from a place where there had been a terrible gun killing, a famous mm-hmm. one. Is guns going to really be an issue that decides it?
Do we have 10 seconds to talk about Martin O'Malley? I couldn't resist that because he just could not get a word in last night, the third candidate, and, you know, he will fade. I do think that it's interesting. I think the more you see of Sanders, I actually think he will begin to drop down again. He gets cross too easily. I was looking at some of the figures. 55% of Democratic voters want experience over change. And he is, despite being older than her, he is the change candidate of the new one, the one we don't know. 55% want experience. And of those 55%, Clinton beats Sanders 77% to 19%. I think the more you see of him, for example, on healthcare, where his idea is that I'll put your taxes up, but don't worry, you won't lose any money because you won't have to pay health insurance, I don't think that's going to go down very well, whereas Clinton will come up with the, what a fantastic thing Obama did, and I'm going to make sure it's rammed through and stays. On gun control, and this surprised me, he's all over the place. He's not really a gun control kind of guy. And he's actually opposing Obama's recent things on gun control. Why? Because it might hurt the mom and pop gun shops. So it's not that he's not one of these guys that just kind of gets just how crazy it is to have, I think it's something like 390 million guns in America. I think he's going to get damaged. He gets crossed too easily. I'm reckoning it's going to be Clinton. But hey, you know, wiser heads than me agree. You know, I'm not an expert. In fact, I've got one opposite me. Clinton or Sanders?
Oh, it's going to be Clinton.
There you go.
Okay. Well, we have some assured agreement there anyway. We're going to take a short break now. You listen to Midori House. Zainia and Tim will still be with me right after this. So stay tuned.
Visiting Maison et Objet in Paris this January? Then come and say bonjour to the Monocle team and help us celebrate the 9th anniversary at our lounge, shop and cafe in Hall 7. Pop in for some smart shopping, peruse exclusive design collaborations and sample the best coffee at the fair, made by Allpress and the Monocle Cafe team. Monocle at Maison et Objet, in association with USM, Nicari and Allpress at Paris Nord Villepinte. from the 22nd to the 26th of January. We look forward to seeing you there.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Zania Wickett from Chatham House and Tim Marshall from the What and the Why.com. To Taiwan now, where a newly elected president is causing concern on the mainland. Tsai Ing-wen and her Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, trounce the Nationalist Party, and many in China are wary of the DPP's somewhat nativist leanings. Chinese state media has already warned Ms. Tsai against any move towards declaring independence. Tim, they're not going to declare independence. It's a nice thing to have in your kind of, you know, remit for your party, but it's just too scary to even contemplate it, isn't it?
That is, yeah. I mean, it's simply it's a division inside Taiwanese politics whether you think we should be completely independent or whether we should go for the Chinese version of one country, two systems. But no one ever actually really means it that they're going to go for independence, because the United States treaty with Taiwan says, we will guarantee your security if you are invaded. However, if you provoke an invasion by declaring independence from China, we will not come to your assistance. And as it's a die-in-the-ditch issue for the Chinese, a declaration of independence will provoke an invasion and the Americans won't come to help. Consequently, that's just public rhetoric. Everyone knows it. It's simply which side of the divide you are on. One country, two systems is not bought by the new generation, your hundreds and thousands of young people in Taiwan. They've seen what's happened in Hong Kong with one country, two systems. They don't like it. That and the domestic issues have swung it for this progressive party against, I mean, when you were a kid and you read about the Kuomintang and Chiang Kai-shek.
Yeah.
Wow, those guys are still there? Yep, and those are the ones that she's beaten.
He's right, isn't he? That America would, you know, America, while keen to see Taiwan remain as kind of bastion of democracy, sitting kind of, you know, poking a finger, as it were, at China, they're desperate for them not to kind of put a foot wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, America has a number of alliance agreements with countries in Asia that make America quite nervous, because it could bring America back into a full-blown war potentially with China. So they are very, very careful about the conditions under which they would follow through. And Tim's quite right. I mean, I think if Taiwan were to be assertive, aggressive, offensive, then they would find America leaning back on their heel and being less than forward-leaning. And as Tim said, I mean, what was interesting, I saw a poll today that the polls are not going the way China would like, where a decade or 15 years ago, I think it was the majority of Taiwanese called themselves Chinese. Mm-hmm. And that is no longer the case. That's down to 14%.
And they're not
like
Han. The majority of people in Taiwan, even those that came from the mainland, are not Han Chinese. 80% of the Chinese are Han. They're not there. So there's this slight ethnic gap. But overall, it comes down to what we've said. The Americans are not going to come to the aid of you if you declare independence. Secondly, 40% of your trade goes where? To China. They've just had a direct flights between them. You know, they're not going to risk all that.
But what is going to happen is the Kuomintang's put an awful lot of effort into building a strong economic relationship with China, building stronger links with China. I mean, if you look at where we were a decade ago and where they are today, and there's been a huge difference. I think that is going to, any increase in links, any increase in trade is going to be taken very, very carefully by the DPP for the next 10 years.
Yeah, it was just very briefly. It was very interesting to see who rang her up. The Americans rang her up very quickly, and Shinzo Abe of Japan rang up very quickly and said, well done, because that's part of the alliance, and it's to do with China, that we just mentioned.
Well, we're going to move on now. We're going to the Swiss Alps as a change of scenery for you, because it's a special week in the tiny town of Davos. It's there each year, high up in the mountains, where heads of state mingle with rock stars and central bankers too, to exchange business cards and chat to some whiz kids from startups. It's the World Economic Forum, even, and an event that's historically been labelled elitist. So new statistics from Oxfam have made for some rather uncomfortable reading. The group claims that the rich richest 1% of people are now wealthier than the rest of humanity combined. And perhaps even more attention-grabbing is the fact that 62 individuals now have wealth of half of the entire planet, or about 3.5 billion people. But does it matter, Tim?
Yes, insofar as there genuinely is this divide between rich and poor, and it's playing into the Western
politics. But there's
always
been a divide between rich and poor.
Yes, but it seems to be accentuated. But why it's important is because there is a mood afoot in some of the Western countries, which is pushing forward demagogues like Trump in the United States. I mean, I know that he's very rich, but that's not the point I'm making. This divide and the narrative of the divide is pushing it. That said, I actually don't think it really matters. I bet you when Henry VIII was in power in the United Kingdom, in England, he probably had more money than the rest of the country put together. You know, plus ça change. The last thing to say is that this is a study that comes out in order to push a certain charity's world view. I'll give you just as many statistics that prove to you that over the past 40 years, partially through globalization, the poorest parts of the world are actually much, much better off than they were. Education levels have risen. Poverty levels have gone down comparatively. And yes, there is this divide, and we do have the super rich, but we always did.
I
was going to drive straight in. I mean, I think the issue, as much as anything else, historically, the divide, the inequality was between countries as much, kind of almost more than it is today, and within countries less than it is today. And the problem with that is what people see the divide much more. And so that changes not just the economics of it, but it actually changes how people feel about that divide and how people are going to respond to it. So, I mean, that's one issue. The other thing is in some respects, a very American point, you have to distinguish between inequality and inequality of opportunity. Because, you know, in the United States, we think of, you know, the U.S. of the dream. Anybody can achieve the dream. Actually, the Chinese are now talking about the Chinese dream, but that's a different dream, I think. And it's the idea that there's no more inequality of opportunity, that people can't actually be born into the bottom fifth and actually, or quintile, and raise up to the top quintile. That is also something that is hugely damaging in this narrative, hugely damaging in terms of the implications of it. The final thing I do want to mention, though, is there are some studies that suggest that inequality is actually damaging for the economy writ large. So the greater the inequality, the less economic growth you see. Now, other studies say no, some studies say yes. That could actually have an economic consequence as well as the kind of moral or the personal consequence.
And I just think we're going to dive into one topic in like 10 seconds in a minute. But I think it's also confusing on a weekend when you see like somebody win $300 million whatever in the lottery in America and everyone's desperate to be that person, super excited about it. No negative coverage at all. You see all of these dot-com billionaires, they wish their companies pay a bit more tax. No real criticism. There's always this kind of mystery, kind of bad industrialist in the background that we kind of hate, but do we? It's such a kind of confused picture what people say and do.
Well, it's just there's another statistic that I always used to like is everybody more than 50% of people think they're above average. Something like 65% of people polled think they're above average, which clearly doesn't actually add up. You know, if you ask people what their economic status is, you know, it's interesting to realize that actually our expectations and our assessment of where we are is not necessarily terribly reflective of actually where we are.
Now, we've only got a minute and 15 seconds, that's it, and we're going to do a whole story in that time. Donald Trump, they're debating in the UK whether he should be allowed to come in the UK or not. He's been a bit rude about people, and his opinions on Muslims have got people rather upset, and he's got terrible hair. Tim, should he come?
Yes, because, very briefly, it's being debated in the UK Parliament because if you get more than 100,000 signatures on a petition, you can have a debate. There's not going to be a vote. If there was, I'd say he should come, not because he's not an odious character, he does appear to be, but because I'm not sure he's broken any law. If you have a hate preacher that says this is how you should beat women, or has been overtly calling for people to be physically harmed, you can ban. This, let him come.
Zenia, you're a potential president of America, and we're talking about saying you can't come.
I don't think anybody takes this terribly seriously. I agree with Tim. You know, he's not going to get banned. He couldn't get banned. Well, not based on what he's already said. He couldn't get banned and he shouldn't be banned. He represents, as we have seen, a significant proportion of the American populace. we have to understand that. We may not like it, but we have to understand it.
And he must love it, don't you think? This is just another thing for him to kind of like say...
Actually, you know, apparently he's not happy about it at all.
Okay, because he wants to come and see his golf course.
Allegedly, he is not happy about this at all.
He wants to have a word with you about your comments on his hair.
Okay, I'll go into hiding. Well, thanks. That's all we have time for today, by the way. And thanks to my special guests, Tim Marshall and Xenia Wickett. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Henry Rhys-Sheridan and by Eugenie Derez. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, Carlotta Ribello will be keeping you company with Monocle's playlist. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show with Mr. Robert Bound. The show will be back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, goodbye.